Welcome to the Vet the Jockey Show. My name is Josh and I'm your host. On the show, I interview entrepreneurs to hear their story and how they overcome challenges in their life and business. I'm also going to let you behind the scenes, behind the mic, into my entrepreneurial journey on a daily journal. Hang on to your horses, you're in for a ride with me, Josh Wilson.
Good day, everyone, and welcome to the Bet the Jockey Show. My name is Josh. I'm a fellow entrepreneur, and I'm traveling around talking to really interesting entrepreneurs and those who support and invest in the entrepreneurial community. On today's show, we're going to have a conversation with a successful investor who was an early investor in NerdWallet and other fintech companies, and he's passionate about helping entrepreneurs get money. So, ladies and gentlemen, welcome Mike to the show. Mike, welcome to the Bet the Jockey Show.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, now I'm looking at your name. Mike, how do you pronounce your last name for the audience?
It's actually Periou. It's kind of how it's spelled, but it's I hear everything from Peru to Perrier, but Periou works fine.
Perfect. Well, I like your name and I do like Perrier also, but this is not sponsored by the show or by Perrier. So let's dive in. You help and you love helping entrepreneurs get money and get money from, you know, specifically from investors. So, you know, why don't we start with, you know, who you are and kind of go through your background so we can, you know, learn from you.
Sure. So I'm originally from New Jersey. And I live in Florida now. I came down for the great weather some years ago. But I've always had kind of this entrepreneurial interest. Even when I was a kid, I was always the one that was, you know, finding old toys, cleaning them up, taking them to the flea market to sell, things like that. So I've always kind of had that entrepreneurial bug. But I didn't pursue it until after I started my career. I studied finance at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. And then I went into corporate finance. I worked for the International Finance Corporation. And it was a very interesting experience because I got to travel around the world and I was given quite a bit of responsibility so early on in my career, helping sell basically energy companies and banks and telecommunications companies. So I really got some great exposure there. But one of the key lessons I took away from that was that given my personality and that interest, that kind of thing that was eating at me on the inside, you should go try your own thing. I did leave that job and went on to be on my own and be an entrepreneur. And this was, about 18 years ago. So a little more 19 years ago when I decided to do that. So it I've basically spent my career, most of my career, as either an entrepreneur and then later on as an advisor and as an investor.
Nice. Now, when I was a kid, I actually grew up in Fort Lauderdale, and I would go with my mom and my Jewish grandma, and we would go to the flea market, the swap shop in Fort Lauderdale, and I would buy Oakleys and other things, and then I would sell them to kids in my school. What were you buying and selling as a kid?
Well, you know, it's crazy because it really had to do with toys at the time, like Transformers, action figures, things like that, where they were pretty easy to acquire when they're used. And there was a lot of interest, you know, among kids for buying these things at a low price. So you could actually acquire them at a low price point, and then you could sell them at a profit, but it was still a very good deal for kids that wanted to buy used toys. I mean, you know, this is pretty early when I, you know, talking about what I was probably like 11 years old, something like that.
Yeah.
And so it, you know, it was an interesting experience because I didn't mind working. You know, I remember sometimes I would be out there, you know, getting stuff ready and then like, listen, Mike, come on, stop. You have to, you know, you have to eat. But yeah, so, you know, I think especially like if, you know, if you have kids and they show that kind of entrepreneurial energy, I think it's a healthy thing to support. Even if they don't go on to be entrepreneurs when they're adults, I mean, it's hard, to sometimes get kids to be passionate about the things that you want them to be passionate about. But if they have this natural tendency, this interest in something, and something that can provide some great skills in life, then I think it's really important to support them. But yeah, that's not what we're here to talk about today.
No, but it's always interesting hearing how people kind of got their start in or when they first started exploring entrepreneurship. So that experience when you were traveling the world as an investment analysis and looking at businesses and exploring that, you said you left that to get into the entrepreneurial world yourself. What was that?
Set the scene. This was back when when it was the first, internet 1.0, and it was a very exciting time. And there were people, starting companies, raising money. There's a lot of energy and excitement around the internet. And I felt, I'm young. I want to do something. I don't want to, this fear of missing out, FOMO.
Yeah.
So that was part of it that motivated me. And, obviously I was young and I made almost every single mistake you can imagine. And one of those mistakes was saying, I want to do something. I don't know what I'm going towards. I don't know what I want to get away from. So I'm just going to jump in, with both feet and see what happens. I probably could have planned a little better. But a friend of mine who was older, he was an MBA student when I was an undergrad. He was a brilliant programmer, and he also was feeling the same thing. So we teamed up and we started a software company. Now they call them software as a service, SaaS. Back then it was called application service provider. And we actually developed a suite of software applications to manage retail chains over the web. Today that's kind of par for the course, but almost 20 years ago, that was pretty innovative and pretty exciting. And so that's what we launched. We launched a company called Possip. We made a few interesting strategic decisions. We decided that because we didn't have a lot of money to start and it was getting very expensive to hire people in the US, we actually started the company in Argentina. So I moved to Argentina because at the time there were a lot of very talented programmers. There was a lot of entrepreneurial energy. And also the cost of living, the cost of running a business was a fraction of what it was in the US. So from our point of view, it was a smart financial move and a smart business move to do that.
Yeah. Now here we come from New Jersey to Argentina, right?
Right.
What was that? I mean, was that a whole major shift in mindset and culture? And I mean, did you stand out like a sore thumb there? Or like, talk to us about that exchange. That seems exciting.
Yes, I had traveled quite a bit for work, and I'd worked in a number of countries. I mean, I worked in sub-Saharan Africa, Central America, South America, Eastern Europe. So for me, it was very comfortable to say, okay, I'm going to go to a foreign country and do this. But there was a little detail that made all the difference in the world. When I was working for a large international financial organization, I would go there, and then doors would open for me. Because I was an executive, a young executive for this important organization doing important work. So once you resign and then you go down as an entrepreneur, those doors aren't there anymore. You don't have the support of the institution behind you. So yeah, you're just another guy that has to kind of crawl his way back to where he wants to go. So it was a bit of a shock at that point. And so then, being an entrepreneur from a different country, even though I had all this experience, it's very different to visit a country, do a transaction, versus opening up, setting up operations, hiring people. It's a very different legal environment. So there were a number of challenges related to the day-to-day work that were kind of the counter to the financial benefit of saving all those costs.
Yeah. So how did that turn out? You did this with a friend, how did it work out? Because sometimes going into business with a friend or a partner has its challenges. Not only did you do that, you moved to a different country, right? So what did that look like for you?
Yeah, I mean, it was very difficult. I mean, from the personal point of view, because we had known each other for some time and we understood each other's personalities, we had a similar work ethic, we had a similar approach to life and what we wanted to accomplish. We kind of got those things out of the way and we were compatible. So in that case, it was good. But, you know, we our timing was off because we were doing this and then months after we started the business, after we had already invested our money, we had the NASDAQ meltdown. And then investment in tech companies basically came to a halt. And the riskier the company, the riskier the proposition, the less likely it was to get investment. And that's exactly what happened to us. You know, we had calculated that we could invest our money to get the company started, have a proof of concept product, some reference clients, and then take that and say, look how smart we are. We built this product and we got our initial customers for a fraction of what it would cost anybody else because we went to this other country. So now, you know, we're looking to do our Series A of investment so we can roll this out in the United States. And we basically were shut down. I mean, it was, I spoke to well over 100 different investors. And, you know, in that case, it was like we were too smart for our own good because we missed kind of the obvious. While we were saving costs, we were actually in South America. We were 8 to 12 hours on a plane away for an investor to come see what we had accomplished. And many investors told us, look, if we can't drive to see what you're doing with our money, we're not interested.
Yeah.
It was difficult also for other investors to say, look, you know, it's great that you're down there, but are there any, you know, legal issues with you know, licensing and patents and you know, you have, you know, these different legal entities because it's different countries. That's too complicated for us. We like it simple. The other thing we found for those that were interested to say, okay, it's great that you have a product. Come back to us when you have a first customer. We would do that. Okay, you have a customer, great. Come back when you have 10. Okay, great. Come back when you have paying customers. Come back when you have this. The goalpost kept moving because the market kept moving and getting riskier. So we didn't manage that as well as we could. So in the end, it was good because we learned because the business had to grow organically. We couldn't use outside capital to kind of fund the growth. It had to come from sales. So it was a great learning experience, very tough. And in the end, it actually did work out, but it took a number of years of hard work.
Yeah. So you were having conversations. You guys were in Argentina. You were finding investors and you're having conversations with them and they say, sorry, it's too far. And there's a saying that angels don't fly, right? You know, they want to invest near, you know, near themselves. So what did that teach you? Because you spoke with 100 investors and now you're an investor yourself and you're helping other people communicate with investors. What did 100 no's teach you?
Well, I think the most important lesson for me was humility when you come to to really start your own business, because you know it's very easy when you're kind of in this you could be in a bubble where you're surrounded by people that believe in your mission and what you're trying to do with your business, so they're going to be supportive. You may have gone, you know, you may have been very successful in your previous career. You may have gone to a great school. You may have people that, you know, just friends and family that are supporting you. And sometimes that kind of creates a bubble and a false sense of expectation regarding what the process is like. The reality is raising money from investors is tough. It's a full-time job and you are going to have to go through a lot of no's. But to me, now I'm on the other side, right? The two takeaways for me is that as an investor, I think it's best to get to a quick no. And as an entrepreneur, you want that quick no. You know, at first, when I was in that spot back then, when it wouldn't even hear me out, I couldn't even finish my pitch and I would get a no, it would upset me. It's like, you're not giving me a chance. But in reality, they were doing me a favor because they weren't wasting my time. Because the minute one of the variables or one of the elements of our business made us to be not a good fit for that fund or that an angel investor, the best thing they could do is say no so I could move on to somebody that was. So to me, the quick no, which many times people don't like, is actually a favor, right? You actually do it. It's a good thing for you. And then, you know, the other thing going through the 100 no's is a lot of that was cold calling. So reaching out on LinkedIn or going to an event where you would meet investors and just, you know, get in their face and start getting, you know, some FaceTime with them, things like that. In reality, if you're cold calling someone, you have to do 10 times as much work, because they have to establish that you're credible. They have to see if you're an honest person, if you know what you're talking about. There's no point of reference for them. You're starting at zero. Now, compare that if you go through an intermediary, someone that you know in common, or someone that the investor trusts, and that person, in effect, is vouching for you. You're not starting at zero. You're not starting at, say, three or four. So you have an incredible advantage compared to the person who's cold calling. So really, that is a more effective approach. You don't just, you know, start firing in every direction, but really have a well thought out plan to go to that 1 degree or 2 degrees of separation, so that when you finally get to meet with the investor, it's more about what you're actually doing now and the opportunity versus can I trust you?
Yeah, what great advice there. Those warm introductions are super valuable. Now, that playing off that, I grew up on the construction site, picking up nails, and my family, we weren't investors. I didn't know any investors growing up. I had to fight and learn how to do this stuff by just pure grit and vinegar, right? So, for an entrepreneur out there, let's just say has a similar background or something, who doesn't know any investors or doesn't know anybody who could set up that warm introduction, but they've got a great idea and they're starting to get traction. How could someone find those kind of warm introductions or intermediary to make an introduction to a potential investor? What's your advice on that?
So I think that especially today, most entrepreneurs, if they think that they don't know someone, they're wrong. It's incredible. Once you start working in the entrepreneurial sector, you start going to events, you start going to meetups, you start networking, people start getting to know you. It's really a pretty small community. I personally have been amazed, and I've been doing this, I'm more on the investing side for about 5 years, how small a community it is on a national level. So I think it's about having a well thought out approach, right? One is, you first have to kind of research the right fit of an investor for you. So before even figuring out, who's my 1 degree of separation, first figure out, who's going to be, the right investor for you, the good fit for you. We can talk about that, if you want, in a minute. Now, how do you actually get to that degree? You first start out with the people you know. If you went to college, who did you go to college to? If you have an attorney that's helping you set up the business, who do they know? Your banker, because if you have a business, you have bank accounts. Who do they know in the local community? The events. You can go to the events. You're not going to walk away with something. At first, you have to go consistently over time. People get to know you, see your face, etc. They can make introductions, right? Part of this is geographically determined. If you're in a city like Miami, New York, San Francisco, Austin, Texas, right? There are communities there. Now, if you're located in not one of these centers, okay, yeah, it might be a little more challenging. But if you really make a list of the people that you know and start reaching out to them, tell them what they're doing, what you're doing, and asking them, hey, do you know anybody that could maybe help me with this or would be interested in looking at this? And I would start that way. So you can start from zero, but if you take a good approach, work your network, the people that know you and trust you, and work out from there, you're going to start finding people that could really help you before you know it.
That's good input. Now, when working with investors, a lot of times, when I was just getting started, I was like, oh, this person has money, right? I was building a tech company, a health and fitness company, technology based, but I saw someone who was in the manufacturing space and they had money. So, I went and talked with them about money, but it was completely different fit. And the advice that I received was absolutely horrible. When you talk about good fit, investment wise or money wise, what do you mean by that?
So sometimes you have to start with friends and family, okay, to get you going. right? So what I'm talking about is beyond the friends and family round. When you're looking to raise some significant money, you know, it could be whatever significant for you. It could be $100,000, it could be $300,000, $500,000, whatever might be the case. But when you're going, when you're going after investors that kind of do this for a living or do this on the side, this idea of fit is absolutely critical. So you mentioned you went to a very successful manufacturing entrepreneur. They're not necessarily going to understand tech if you're the first tech investment. Now, what happens if you are and you try to pursue that? You're going to have to educate that person on why they should invest in a tech company. That takes a lot of time, and the success rate is low. You don't have time to educate someone on the benefits of investing in technology. If they don't believe it yet, it's best to move on to people that have already invested in companies and are actively involved in angel investing, or if you're a larger round, if it's a VC firm. So to me, the first thing is I'd be very cautious in terms of saying I'm going to dedicate my limited resource of time to convince people that have never invested in a startup to invest in a startup, because you know that can be complicated. But also, I get all kinds of cold calls, emails, LinkedIn messages from people that are entrepreneurs. They have a startup. They're looking for capital, and I can tell pretty quickly that they haven't done any research. You know, I'm not a venture capital firm. So if you're looking for your Series A and $2 million, I'm not the guy to talk to, right? But if you're emailing me your deck specifically looking for that, we haven't talked before, it tells me that you haven't really done any research on me. So you haven't spent any time on it. So, you know, basically you're not an efficient entrepreneur when it comes to fundraising. So what does that say necessarily about maybe other elements of your business and how you run it? So, you know, everything you do, everything you say is a signal. Right? So what are you signaling when you're just kind of cold calling or cold emailing everybody? So you want to look at, for example, what size of investment, what stage of investment they're at. The geography, like I mentioned, is critical. You want to find someone local. There's a company that, I was speaking with recently that they've actually decided to relocate from Miami because they've been traveling to San Francisco and there's quite a bit of interest in them out there. They haven't been able to raise it here. So they've actually taken the risky move of moving their company. But in that case, it made sense for them. Some of the other things you want to look at is the track record of the investor, because it's important. It goes both ways. You know, this person and you are going to have a relationship that may last many years, and it's going to go through good times and bad. So you want to see what kind of track record they are. You can search online, ask other people, are they litigious people? Are they suing, people for different reasons, things like that? Are there any red flags you kind of want to avoid from your end? Also, have they made any competitive investments? If they just invested in a company that is doing exactly what you're doing or very similar, then you might want to question, why do they want to go through due diligence? Are they interested in investing, or are they just trying to get information, right? So they have to trust you, but you also have to establish a level of comfort for them. And that's why going through somebody an intermediary is so valuable, because on both sides that can, that can help. So if you, it's better to invest a little time at the beginning, see if they're a good fit. And if so, then proceed hitting all of the, reaching out to all the targets on your list through those intermediaries.
Yeah. So you mentioned a good point. Like there's some investors out there. Now, 99% of the people out there, I believe investors wise, angels and up, I believe are good, right? But there's some that aren't. And when you talk about like they will take a conversation maybe to gain some information because they've invested in a competitor, and they'd be happy to listen into what you're saying. How could you protect yourself as a founder from those kind of people? And then also I never sign NDAs, in initial conversations and such like that. But, what's your stance on that? So how do you protect yourself from an investor or a group that is just having a conversation with you to take your knowledge? And what's your stance on initial NDAs for conversations?
Well, an initial NDA is basically a non-starter. And no serious investor would, before first meeting, sign an NDA, and an entrepreneur that asks for that, I mean, that's kind of a tell. It's a signal that, you know, you're not very experienced and you haven't kind of researched how this process works.
Yeah.
So today, you know, unless this is your fifth venture and the first four have sold for nine figures, you're really not going to, you should not ask for an NDA at the beginning. It's not a good way to start a relationship. You have to be sharp and you have to be smart. So if you know, if there's information out there, right? So do your research to see if they have invested in a competitive company. And I would ask about that. You know, I would ask straight up. So I know you invested in this company. You know, we're kind of in a similar space. So how do you envision if you proceed, if you decide to invest in us, you know, how would that work? I would ask. I mean, one, it shows you're smart. You're worried about what's your interests. And two, you've done your research. So it sends good signals to the investor. And I think it's a completely reasonable question. Now, if you don't have that information and you have a doubt, then you have to be smart about how much information you give. I mean, the first meeting, and this is critical, meeting where you're pitching your deck, that is not the meeting where you're going to get an investment, right? I mean, that's the meeting where your goal from that first meeting is really to get them interested and to want more information and to start a conversation. So give away a strategic amount of information in that first meeting. Give them enough to understand there's a great opportunity here. You and your team, or if it's just you, have the ability to execute on this opportunity. And you're looking for the right partners, not just the money, but the strategic part to help you accomplish that, right? Get them interested. And then as you get to know each other, you provide more information. And then eventually when you get to the due diligence stage, you're going to have to show them everything. But then at that point, you will have signed an NDA and then you have more protection.
Got it. Do you think a lot of it, you know, when working with you or with what you've seen other entrepreneurs do, do you feel that people go in and ask for money far too soon and they're going into that first meeting going, I'm walking away with a check?
Many do, not all, but there are many that think that that first meeting is where they have to sell you on everything. So, I mean, it's really, and, you know, to me, I think entrepreneurs, if you're asking for money, you really need to practice how to do it. I mean, it's a skill on how to make a proper presentation, how to present your company to investors. And most entrepreneurs don't have that skill. And, you know, I've reviewed over the years easily, I haven't counted, but 1,000, 2,000 meetings that I've sat through and presentations and bake-offs where companies are pitching. And but you can tell the ones that have done it 50 times and have received 50 no's because they've taken what they've learned from that. And, you know, the presentations are short. They get to the point. The salient issues and the most important elements are very clear, very crisp, versus some entrepreneurs where, you know, they expect somebody to sit through a 45-minute or a 60-minute presentation. There's like 80 slides. There's all this information there that's way too much for an initial meeting. And so sometimes they're kind of taken aback when you say, look, we have 10 minutes for the initial pitch. And then, you know, if we're interested, you know, let's talk another 20, 30 minutes with Q&A. And then that's it. You know, that's the first meeting there. So I think managing your expectation in terms of what you can get out of the first meeting is important, because you don't want to be disappointed because you just didn't know what you should have expected. So absolutely. Really, people need to practice their pitches. I mean, that's so important. You know your business. If you've been working at it, say, for a year, and you've been in the industry for your whole career, you know it so well. That doesn't necessarily mean that the audience understands it as well as you do. So sometimes I also see that on one end, there's too much information. On the other end, there's jumps in the logic, or there's a jump from here's the premise, and then they skip three steps and they give you the conclusion because the person doesn't realize that, you know, for them it might be innate, but not necessarily for the audience. So, you know, it's about practicing in front of people that don't know about your business. It's about practicing in front of people that you typically wouldn't talk to about this, to kind of see what kind of questions you're going to get, right?
Yeah, that's really good input. You talk about kind of like this process of getting investment dollars, like and you even said like fundraising is a full-time job. Now, for entrepreneurs out there, founders, CEOs of these startup companies, they're running, you know, they're trying to get sales, they're trying to run a team, and now they have to go do this, you know, fundraise thing. How can it, you know, what advice do you have for these founders out there who need to raise capital, especially when they're running a team, trying to build a product, trying to sell the product? What's your advice there?
Yeah, there's no easy answer. I mean, in an ideal situation, you would be cash flow break even from your customers, because that way you can pay the bills and you have a little bit of breathing room. But what you typically find isn't that situation. What you find is you're burning more cash, right, than you're bringing in, if you're bringing in any cash at all. And you might have 3 months, 4 months, 5 months, maybe 6 months of cash left. And you're like, okay, well, we're going to have to raise money. So, well, you know, if you're already at that point, right, then you're putting yourself under tremendous pressure because you only have 6 months to raise the money. And then what's going to happen, your sales are going to have to suffer because now you're going to have to spend a large percentage of your time on the fundraising. So my first piece of advice is, if you think that you're going to need to raise money from investors, then from day one, you start dedicating a percentage of your time to that process. The majority of your time has got to be on building the business because that's the stage you're at. But start from day one. Because let me tell you, I mean, to me, what I really like, and you know, one of the companies that I'm very actively involved in now as an advisor and in other capacities as well. So the two founders, they sat down with me when it was just the two of them putting together an IKEA table at their first office and like, we want to do this, right? And so I've been with them from the very beginning. It's 3 years now since they started the business, and I have seen the company grow. So at points where they needed capital, I already know them. It's a relationship. So now it's more about, okay, how much do you need? What are the use of proceeds? What are you going to do with the money versus getting to know each other? So it can take, depending on, you know, where the market is, it's not necessarily a 3 or a 6 month process. It could be over a year of where you're communicating with an investor before they're actually willing to write a check. So don't shoot yourself in the foot by thinking, you know, once I hit my milestones, then we'll get the money when we need it. So that's definitely a bad assumption. And the other thing too is, and this is more for the solo entrepreneurs, unless you have a very scalable, very profitable business, you really should consider having at least one partner in the business. So that way one can work on the operations, on the business itself, and another one can focus during that time on more the fundraising and the other elements to help grow the business, because one person by themselves doing it is very difficult.
That's really good input. So as an investor yourself and working with all the investors, that if a solopreneur comes to you and is seeking capital, is that a red flag for you if they haven't developed a team or another, you know, co-founder or leadership partner? Is that a red flag for you actually?
What it does, it is a red flag if they are not right at the beginning. Because if they're just starting out, okay, then, you know, it's a little too early for me to invest, but at least we can start that relationship. I can help guide you, introduce you to some people that maybe would be a good fit. What I find though is that if you've been in business for a while, you have customers, etc., and you're the solo entrepreneur, what that tells me is that maybe you're not the person that's comfortable taking advice from somebody else or listening to other opinions, that it has to be your way. And now, if you're a genius, then great, I get it, and that's wonderful for your investors, but most people aren't geniuses, and most people are going to benefit from the advice of others that have more experience or different experience than they do. So I need to feel comfortable in my case, and many investors that I know, that you are the kind of person that will listen to advice, that will take advice, that you're coachable. Because the idea of just taking my money and then I keep quiet, that's also not interesting to me or most investors. Okay, once I give you my money, I now have a vested interest in ensuring your success, and I want to help you succeed. That's what I'm here for. So I want to know that if I have some advice to give you, that it's going to be considered. You don't always have to take it. We don't always have to agree. But I want to know that you're listening and you're considering it. So if I get any sense that the person's ego doesn't allow them to do that, then yes, it's absolutely a deal breaker. And this is the issue of being an entrepreneur, right? It's this duality, as I see it. On the one hand, you have to be very proud, very confident. You have to be assertive. You have to believe in what you're doing like 110%, because this is so hard, you know, to start a business, grow it, and make it successful. People telling you no, you have to just keep pushing through. But at the same time, you have to be very humble, because you have to realize that you don't have all the answers. You need to listen to others. You're going to fail. It's part of it. You have to be able to get yourself back up. So it's a combination of pride and humility that you need to get. You need to really tune that properly in order to succeed.
Nice. Yeah, I agree with that. When it comes to, you talk about being coachable and being able to take advice. Let's talk about advisory boards, not you know, board of directors or, you know, official boards, but like, let's talk about building out an advisory team. Do you look for that before you make an investment? Like, who are your advisors? Who are you taking advice from? Are you coachable? Is that something you look at? And if someone doesn't have that, what advice do you have for them?
So I think an advisory board is a great way for an entrepreneur to get started, because one, they're just advisors, right? So if they're on the board of directors, then there's a legal relationship there that, you know, in terms of, you know, accountability, and, you know, you don't know if these are the right people for that yet, since you're just starting out. So rather than making such a huge commitment as putting somebody on your board of directors, I think it's smart to start out as an advisory board, because sometimes you don't know if that advisor is actually going to give you advice, if they're going to be active, if they're too busy. So an advisory board is a great way to start. It's also a really smart way to get people interested in what you're doing that could potentially open doors to investors, to employees, things like that. Because, well, I'm an advisor, so that kind of creates a relationship there. There's a bond. I want to help you if I'm willing to say yes. So in that case, you now have somebody that can see how you're growing, see what you're doing, is providing input, and they can say, look, you know, Josh, this is great. Love what you're doing. I want to introduce you to my friend who invests in deals. I want to introduce you to this law firm. They're going to help you out. I want to, et cetera, et cetera. So the advisory board is a great way for the entrepreneur to get the advice, get the help, but without having that long-term, permanent legal commitment to someone yet. When you get, you know, later on, when you're looking for maybe more, you know, very high-end strategic advisors, then that dynamic will change a little bit. But when you're starting out, it's a great way to do it. So yeah, I absolutely think it's a good sign. If you don't have one, then that doesn't necessarily mean, you know, it's a deal breaker. To the contrary, if it's a good entrepreneur, it's a good opportunity, then it gives me as an investor the chance to help put together an advisory board. Because again, if I'm interested in you, I want to do everything I can to help you succeed. That's the approach I'm going to take.
Okay. So, let's just say I don't have an advisory board. I've got a really awesome fintech company that, you know, that I'm building. It's really great. I got an excellent co-founding team. I've got, you know, some traction in the market, but I don't have an advisory board. And I come to you and I go, Mike, I need your help. You know, what should I look for in an advisor? What do I offer them? How do I make sure that it's a good fit? Like, what advice do you have on building that board out?
Sure. Okay. So the first thing is expectations management, right, on both sides. So you as an entrepreneur, what's it realistic for you to expect from an advisor? And what I think is realistic is to say, you know, meeting every 3 or 4 months in person, kind of tell them what's going on, you know, an email every 3 or 4 weeks with a question here and there. That level of engagement, I think, is reasonable. You know, once a year, that's not reasonable for the entrepreneur. You need more than that. And continually, you know, like making them part of a team, like almost a consultant, that's also not realistic. That's not fair to the advisor, right? So expectations management is important. Number two is understand where are you weak, right? So are you a product guy? Are you a tech entrepreneur, but you need help more on the business development side? You need help more on understanding, you know, business models and pricing and things like that. So based on the need that you have, that's the type of advisor you want to go for. And let's say you're not in one of the major cities where you have access to a lot of people, but, you know, maybe there's a university that you're close to and that I'm sure that they might have professors, academics in the business school or the Department of Economics, or maybe in, you know, on the research side, engineering, et cetera, where they would be interested. I mean, you'd be surprised at how many people with great experience and credentials are available at universities, and people aren't necessarily knocking on their door because they're not in San Francisco or New York or one of these major cities. So that, you know, that's one way you could, you know, take a look at advisors. And the other thing too is I would, anybody that is in your network, let them know that you're looking for some advice or some help with your business on the area that you need help in.
Yeah. Now, what do you offer them? So you set expectations, right? Make sure it's a good fit, that you could, you know, that they could add value, that they understand the market, they understand your product, they understand maybe how to open doors or to grow this. You know, what do I offer them? So I go up to you, Mike, and I go, hey, Mike, I want you to, you know, be on my advisory board. We've been working together for a really long time. I built that trust with you. I'd like you to come on my advisory board. What should I offer you?
So typically what I recommend at this point, and again, this is the scenario where you're an entrepreneur, you haven't really raised money yet, okay? And this is kind of your first advisory board that you're putting together. The type of person that's going to be valuable to you at that particular stage, okay, is someone that isn't necessarily going to do it because you're compensating them, you're paying them. So my recommendation is to kind of hold off on the compensation part. Let the advisor kind of show, prove their value a little bit, okay? And I think that's reasonable. Okay, if somebody goes in to say, okay, I'm going to be on the advisory board, I'll meet with you, you know, twice a year for coffee, send me, you know, email once a month, and it's going to cost you this much in equity or in this much in cash, that to me is probably, it's probably not a good fit, right? Later on, after, you know, if you have money, raise capital, you're looking for more high profile names that can open doors, especially with sales, with customers, things like that. When you're a little further along, then you can start entertaining those discussions. But I think that somebody that just wants to provide advice at the beginning, then, you know, you can kind of hold off on that a little bit. You know, what I've also seen is, for example, they're an advisor, uncompensated at the beginning for a period of time. And then, you know, after a certain period of time, you see that they're adding value to you and you want to lock them in and you want to get them more involved. That's then you can start, you know, maybe talking about that on a non-cash, on an equity basis. Another option is to say maybe you want them to be a general advisor, not compensated, but there's specific things that you want them to build for you, put together for you, and then you're going to compensate them for that, more like on a consulting basis. So, you know, that's the other approach that I've seen as well.
Okay. Yeah, that's really good input. In terms of size of advisory board, so, you know, we're going through the steps. You know, I'm a great founder. I've got a co-founding team, like, and I'm looking to build out that advisory early stage, right? We might have done our friends and family, and we're kind of going for our seed or series. Like, how big of the team should I look for?
Well, you know, if you can get advisors that are valuable and helpful and they're not charging you, then I would get as many of those as you can. You know, if you can have that kind of advisory board, say five advisors, for example, I mean, that would be great. But if you have one or two that are really strategic in terms of helping you fill in the gaps in your execution, then I think that that's great as well. Realistically, I mean, you're not going to have, you know, sometimes you see decks with, you know, 10 advisors and, you know, 15 advisors and things like that. And sometimes the sense when you see that and it's not a famous entrepreneur is that, you know, they're kind of just padding it a little bit. Maybe the people have said, yeah, you know, we can put us in the deck, but are they really active? You know, do they really know what's going on? Because it's kind of not realistic, I think, if you have just one or two people in your business and then you have 15 advisors, you know, how, I mean, just managing the advisors is kind of a job, right? So so I think it should be the right people and the right number of people that are actually adding value. The purpose of the advisor is to help you. And the way that I think they can best help is by filling in the execution gaps, whether it's on the raising money, getting customers, or on the product development side.
Yeah, that's really good. So now let's talk money. This is the fun. You know, we've gone through the steps. We've gone through the process. We've given the first pitch. You know, we did our 10-minute pitch. We practiced it a million times in front of the mirror, in front of, you know, grandma and mom and all these other people. And we nailed that first meeting. They asked for a follow-up meeting with the, you know, the investment group. And finally, we're getting down to the offer, right? Or the ask. Like what happens there in that ask period?
Yeah, and this is critical, right? So you know, there's the, you know, how much money to ask for. There's, you know, what is the method or the modality? What's the investment vehicle? Is it are they convertible notes? Is it straight equity? And then there's the valuation, okay? And all three of those are important. So to me, the amount of money that you're asking for has to be driven by the business need. You know, you're how much cash do you need to get to break-even cash flow, if that's the stage you're at, or how much cash do you need to reach the next critical milestone? So it's not based on, you know, how much you think you can get if you're in a hot market. It's really based on the business need, because if let's assume you're doing some super hot deal, you're in an industry, etc., let's get as much cash as we can. Yeah, but then you're gonna have to give up a lot of equity, right, just to take more cash, which you may not have a proper use for. So the amount of money has to be based on your financial projection, on your business model. Okay, that to me is number one. So that's why modeling is really important, having an understanding of the cost and the potential risk to your revenues, which is an area that I think entrepreneurs really need to work on, understanding the business behind their product and understanding the numbers behind the business. You know, in terms of the method, I mean, typically the convertible note is a vehicle that is used by startups. And, you know, you're not familiar with that, you can read up a bunch of it online. You know, most of the tech law firms have a lot written up on this. There's some other structures out there that, you know, like 500 startups and, you know, a lot of these, you know, incubators and accelerators that they propose, and some entrepreneurs use these different units. But typically your convertible note, which in effect is debt that's converting into equity based on particular milestones in the term sheet, that's a vehicle that is comfortable. The valuation is what I want to talk about, really, because this is what I have seen, for example, many times, is somebody's raising money from friends and family. Friends and family are unsophisticated. And then they have this ridiculously high valuation for an idea. Okay, let's say it's a $5 million or $10 million valuation on an idea, and the friends and family are happy to invest in that because, you know, they haven't, you know, done this before. Well, now you've just, you know, you just caused yourself a tremendous problem, because when you need money to really grow, you're going to need experienced, seasoned investors to help you with that. And your company is likely not going to be ready for a valuation that you've raised from the unsophisticated investors. So you've shot yourself in the foot, because you either have to A, do a down round where the valuation goes down, you have to compensate your earlier investors, and it sends a really bad signal to the market, or you have to basically grow into this valuation, which, you know, if you could do that, then you probably wouldn't be raising money at that point. So it's very important to be smart about valuation and understand what the multiples are, and what, you know, how the valuation is set up for a company in your particular industry and for your particular stage, right? Because otherwise, it really creates a problem. And then the valuation is probably going to be a lot less than what you think it should be, which goes back to only raise what you need, so that you're not giving away too much of the business at a point where it's not worth a lot. So all of this kind of interplays. Now, if you don't know, you know, what's a value, for example, you know, maybe if you're, you know, a software as a service company, and in your particular sector, you're seeing that they're trading at, you know, 80 times monthly revenue, for example. That's kind of what a lot of the deals have been happening at when you do your research. So if your company is doing, you know, $10,000 a month, and it's 80 times that, then you have an $800,000 valuation. That's just, you know, an example. So if you're going in there with a $5 million pre-money valuation, then you're going to have, you know, you're going to have a problem there. So having a realistic expectation of what that should be, I think is critical.
Got it. So who could these entrepreneurs go to, yourself included? Like, how could they find out what they should raise, like in terms of like what should we offer? Are we doing convertible notes? Are we doing equity? Are we doing all these different types of, you know, ICOs, this and that, right? You know, who should they go to seek that advice? And then, it, you know, the valuation in their company, like how can an entrepreneur who has no clue how to do this start to do this?
Well, let's say worst case scenario, you have absolutely no clue. Okay. And you have no one that, that can help you with this. Okay. But you do have access to some investors. Well, you know what, then you just have to do it. And, you know, you basically do some research, start an evaluation and see what the reaction is from those first investors, which is kind of, you know, one thing you could do is save, right, your top in potential investors, the ones that you really think could invest. Maybe those shouldn't be the ones that you go to first, right? Maybe you go to the ones where there's less of a chance for them to invest in you, and so you can make the mistakes with them. They're going to give you the feedback. Your valuation is ridiculous. It's too high. It's too low. Or, you know, it doesn't make any sense. Get that feedback from those that maybe aren't the best fit for you, and then take that knowledge and you go to the ones that are the best fit. So you don't want to kind of risk going to your best shot, messing up on something that you shouldn't have messed up on, and then you're kind of in a tough spot.
That's great advice. So talk to us about, I mean, you've given a tremendous amount of value. So let's just say there's an entrepreneur out there who would like to work with you. And you know, they're about to raise some capital. They've got some proof of concept. They got a little bit of traction, and they need to raise some money. So they go to you and they go, Mike, how could you help? What do you look like? Like, what's that look like with you?
Sure. Well, I mean, in terms of, you know, my on the investment side, I mean, I typically focus where I can drive, because I went and I learned that lesson. So I focus primarily on in South Florida, even though my previous investments are not just in South Florida, but now just based on you know, my current approach, I'm just looking for local businesses where I can kind of roll up my sleeves and play a role in helping them grow. So that's the first, you know, that's the first thing. But what I do like to do, and I'm happy to do this, is always, you know, provide feedback on pitches. And also on financials, because to me it's it's a shame if you have a great product, great opportunity, but then, you know, maybe your pricing structure absolutely makes no sense, or your cost assumptions are based on the wrong variables, and things like that, where then the focus for an investor is like, well, wait a minute, you know, they don't really understand the business behind what they're trying to do, where maybe, you know, in just an hour, talking to somebody that knows about this, you could have kind of realized this, fixed it, and then you're in a much stronger position for the investor. So to me, you know, I think when you're going out to raise money as an entrepreneur, you have to invest in yourself, arm yourself with the best deck, the best, you know, projections, and really have a good sense of, you know, have the information that you need so you know what you can ask for. So that's something that, you know, I like to do. I sometimes speak at events, sometimes people reach out to me, you know, on LinkedIn, things like that. So if it's interesting and when you come to me, you know, you make a compelling case, right? As to, you know, why, you know, I should take a look at this, then I usually do.
Okay. So with that, how could people find you and learn more about you and your business and your investments?
Sure. Well, the best way, in either one way, to be LinkedIn, where, you know, I'm Mike Perry, and also, you know what, you know, if your listeners, if they want to shoot me an email, they can do that at mike@perryu.com.
Excellent. Excellent. Mike, this has been such a fun conversation talking about how to fundraise, how to get money, from investors. You added a tremendous amount of value to myself and my audience. And I just want to say thank you for what you're doing here and then in the entrepreneurial ecosystem.
Well, it's been a pleasure and I really enjoyed speaking with you, and I hope it was helpful to the listeners.
Yeah. Are there any questions that I should have asked you that I completely missed the mark on?
Well, you know, the next time we talk, if you'd like, we can maybe get a little deeper into what a good financial model looks like for an entrepreneur, and maybe what are some of the traps that I usually see when they present to investors on their deck. So the numbers more.
Oh, excellent, excellent, excellent. Well, Mike, thanks for listening in, or thanks for thanks for having a conversation. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening into this Bet the Jockey conversation with investor Mike Perriou, who has offered a tremendous amount of value on how to fundraise. Ladies and gentlemen, if you go to the show notes in this episode, I'll include his LinkedIn, and you'll be able to connect with him there. And you know, just thank you guys for being an entrepreneur and listening into the show. We really appreciate you. Mike, have a wonderful day. Thank you again for this great conversation.
Thanks.
All right. Bye, everyone. Talk to you all on the next episode.